Previously on The Accidental Terrorist.
The year is 1987, the time late February. Our hero, Elder Bill Shun, an outwardly devout 19-year-old from Utah, has been called to serve 2 years as a missionary in the wild and foreign land of Alberta, Canada. Severely homesick, he has already attempted to flee his mission, only to be turned back and convinced to give it another go. But then, faced with another missionary, Elder Finn, trying to run away, Elder Shun does the unthinkable, phones in a bomb threat in a last-ditch effort to keep Finn from leaving. Elder Shun is now free on bail, having spent a long night in the Calgary City Jail. But his trials are just beginning.
The Accidental Terrorist. A memoir by William Shun. Chapter 32. Lamb to the Slaughter.
After a night spent tossing and turning, I slept late Wednesday morning. Late for a missionary, anyway. My father didn't wake me until 8, and after I had showered and dressed, Sister Tuttle served me a farm-style breakfast with plenty of eggs, sausage, and gravy. President Tuttle received my father and me in his study after breakfast. The room might have belonged to a genteel academic if not for all the gospel-related books on the shelves.
"We go to court at 2 this afternoon," he told us. "We'll meet with Fred Harvey beforehand to review our strategy, but I thought maybe the best strategy we could pursue this morning would be a father's blessing. A father's blessing has special power, and if ever the time for one was appropriate, it's now."
So I sat in an overstuffed leather chair while, for the second time within 2 days, two bearers of the Melchizedek priesthood stood behind me and laid their hands on my head. This time, though, one of the men was my father, and when he invoked the name of the Lord and portentously promised that guardian angels would watch over me in court that afternoon, I felt a definite sense of comfort. My father and I killed the morning at the mission office. I played a lot more piano, and my father swapped stories with the apes. We popped out briefly to buy copies of the Herald and the Sun, and found stories on the afternoon's court date in both papers. As noon approached, Prez invited my father and me to join him for lunch before our meeting with President Harvey. The day was sunny and cool, with a gentle nip to the air. But gauzy gray clouds haunted the horizon. President drove us to a nearby Wendy's in his big white Chevy Celebrity. My father balked at the counter when President tried to pay for our lunches.
"We don't want to be a burden to the mission," he said.
"What else is your tithing money for?" asked President Tuttle jovially.
My father didn't laugh. To him, tithing money was no joke. He paid for his lunch himself, and for mine as well. Over our old-fashioned hamburgers, Prez related his struggles to keep the mission running smoothly through the crisis.
"It's been hard," he said. "Every missionary in the city wants to be there at court. But we can't stop proselytizing, and we really can't have 50 elders running loose in that courthouse. How could I keep the reporters from getting at them? You just know one of those boys is going to pop off with something stupid, and there it'll be on the 6 o'clock news. So I had to send the word down yesterday that no one's allowed to attend."
This was the first I'd heard about it. "But Elder Snow will still be there, right?" I asked. "He's my companion, right? He's got to." President Tuttle shook his head and swallowed a bite.
"I'm sorry, Elder Shun. Elder Snow did come to me last night and ask me for special permission. He made a good case for himself, he really did, but if I'd said yes to him, then I would have had to have let Elder McKay come as well. And then someone else, and it would have been a circus."
The lump of burger I'd just eaten sat like lead shot in my stomach.
"God bless him, though. Elder Snow said he understood and he'd support my decision."
Tuttle swigged at his Sprite.
"Not like those pesky sisters."
"What sisters?" asked my father. Judas Proust, I thought. I knew.
Roper, Steed, and Herzog, said President. They're in your son's district. What is it you call them, Elder Shun? Elder Snow told me once.
I winced. Doper, Weed, and Mad Dog? I ventured. Prez snorted in amusement.
That's it! And you should have seen them all sniveling at me last night in my office. In they come, just weeping and wailing, using up all my Kleenexes, throwing themselves on the floor, crying, President!
And here he shifted to a mocking tone of voice.
Oh, President, it's all our fault. Oh, please, President, you have to let us go. If anything happens to Elder Shun, we'll kill ourselves. Oh, please!
He heaved an aggrieved sigh.
A simple no wasn't good enough for them. I finally had to say, Sisters, I'm only going to tell you this once, so I hope you're paying attention. If I catch you anywhere near that courthouse tomorrow, if you so much as set one foot outside your pross area without my permission, I will excommunicate all three of you. End of story. Are we clear? That shut them up, let me tell you. Those sisters turned pale as ghosts.
He laughed and ate two French fries, and I was left to ponder the awe and majesty of the wartime powers of a mission president. President Harvey's law firm occupied the fifth floor of a sturdy building on Riverfront Avenue downtown, overlooking the placid waters of the Bow. We arrived an hour and a half before our scheduled court appearance. Harvey's private office was large and bright, with Spartan beige furnishings. Wide windows admitted reflections off the water, but the room itself smelled dry, with hints of sandalwood and old books. We sat in a grouping of simple Swedish chairs away from the fragile-looking desk. Leaning forward, President Harvey rested elbows on knees and clasped his hands, his spare frame folded into his chair. He looked directly at me, the overhead lights glittering off his rimless glasses. He barely glanced at my father and President Tuttle.
Now, Elder, let me explain a little about what happens this afternoon, he said. This isn't a trial we're going to. It's a hearing, where the judge decides whether or not there's sufficient evidence to hold a trial, and where you get to elect how you want to be tried. A jury trial's not always your right in Canada like it is in the United States. Only if the crime you're charged with carries a maximum sentence of at least 5 years. In that case, you can choose to be tried with or without a jury, whichever way you think you'll get fairer treatment. Are you with me so far?
I'm with you, I said.
Good. Now, I've got bad news and worse news. The bad news is we've drawn a judge for our hearing this afternoon named Josiah Feather. He's impossible to read. Some judges on this circuit, a case like this, they'd throw it out without a second thought. Others would put you right back in the pokey if they could. But Judge Feather's unpredictable. He's a toss-up. You can never guess which way he's going to lean. Taking your case before him is a risk. I nodded to show my understanding, but inside I was cringing that my lawyer had actually used the word pokey. So, we have an important decision to make here. Harvey continued. We can ask for a delay in the hearing in the hope we'll draw a more sympathetic judge next time around. Of course, if we do that, we might actually draw a worse judge, so there's risk there too. You wouldn't be able to leave Calgary either, not until the new hearing, and that could be 4 or 5 months from now. In the meantime, with your work permit suspended, you won't be able to proselytize. As a naturally lazy boy, that part of it didn't sound so bad. But my father spoke up before I could say anything.
Bill didn't come out on a mission to twiddle his thumbs, he said. He's here to work. Let's go ahead with the hearing today. Everything's going to be okay.
I still wasn't convinced of that, but President Tuttle expressed his agreement, so I nodded my head as well. I might be a legal adult, but apparently the decisions here were all going to be out of my hands.
All right, fine. That's the way I was leaning too, said Harvey. I'm glad we're in agreement. So now, for the worst news. Elder Shun, I don't know how to tell you this exactly, but the prosecution wants to prefer a more serious charge against you than public mischief.
Good gravy, I thought, closing my eyes as if bracing for an explosion.
What is it?
Hijacking, said President Harvey. I flew up out of my chair. "What?" I cried. "How can they do that?"
"Let me ask you a question, Elder," said Harvey, looking up at me with calm sympathy. "And this is a very serious question, so please think about it hard. Elder, where was that airplane when you made your bomb threat?"
I sat down again, feeling both foolish and confused.
"What do you mean, where was it? It was on the runway. Where else would it be?"
"Are you sure?"
"Of course I'm sure. Why wouldn't I be?"
Harvey stood up and crossed to one of his bookshelves.
"I'm glad you think so," he said from across the room, "but you were wrong."
He located a thick book and began leafing through it. "In fact, the plane was still in the air at the time of your call. It was on its way from Edmonton to Calgary, and it was only scheduled to be on the ground for about 15 minutes, just long enough to take on passengers and luggage before continuing to Salt Lake City. The tower didn't even tell the pilot about the bomb threat until the plane was on the ground."
He found the page he was looking for and carried the book over to me, like St. Peter displaying the Book of Life.
"Here's the legal definition of hijacking in Canada," he said, setting it down on the coffee table in front of me. He tapped a paragraph highlighted in pink. I read the passage, and I felt like throwing up. The law was just ambiguous enough to allow any threat made against an airplane while it's in the air, whether the person making the threat is present or not, to be construed as hijacking. And hijacking, according to the highlighted passage, carried a maximum sentence of life in prison.
"No, based on your understanding of the plane's location," said Harvey, taking his seat, "I'm sure we can beat this hijacking charge. If we can avoid it, though, I'd rather not have to deal with it at all. What I propose is to offer Wilfred Ritchie, he'll be the lead prosecutor, to offer him a deal. If he wants to run with the hijacking charge, then we plead not guilty. And if you are found guilty, we appeal and keep appealing as high as we can go. We'll tie this case up for years if we have to. Years. If he comes back down to the original charge, though, we'll agree to plead guilty. I mean, you made 3 confessions. What else can we do? So what's your preference?
Fight a hijacking charge or plead guilty to public mischief?"
It didn't seem like much of a choice. All of us agreed.
"Let's try for the lower charge," said my father.
"Good, good," said Harvey. "I think that is the right choice. No, Elder Shun, if Prosecutor Ritchie goes for the deal and we plead guilty to public mischief, the hearing goes automatically into sentencing. When it does, the question at issue will be whether you get time in jail or merely a fine. We'll be arguing for the fine, of course, but expect the prosecution to ask for a fairly stiff sentence. And I have to warn you, we won't be out of the woods. Public mischief carries a maximum sentence of 10 years in prison itself."
I stiffened in my chair, every square inch of my skin galvanized.
"Holy crow," I said.
So much for Constable Remington's belief that public mischief was a minor offense.
"I doubt they'll ask for anything that high," said Harvey, "but you do need to be prepared for what happens when the judge passes sentence. If he hands you a prison term, then it starts right that instant. Out the back door of the courtroom and directly to jail. Do not pass go, do not collect $200. You go right that second, and you don't get a chance to say goodbye."
His expression darkened.
"Elder, you must be prepared to spend time in the pokey."
That word again! It was like fingernails on slate.
"It won't necessarily be so bad in there," President Tuttle chimed in brightly. "Have you ever met President Merriweather? He's my second counselor."
I shook my head. I'm not sure I was aware until then that mission presidents even had counselors.
"Well, President Merriweather's the dentist at Spy Hill, and he thinks he can get you on as an orderly, and..."
I shook my head.
"I'm sorry, what?"
"Spy Hill's a minimum security prison," said President Harvey, shooting Tuttle a strange look. "If you do get prison time, we can probably get you put there, and at least you'll have work to do and you won't be so bored."
Harvey droned on, but an awful horror had stolen over me. They were prepared for me to go to prison.
They were expecting it. My prospects had never seemed so bleak.
No, said President Harvey. Let's put together a list. I want to hear every good thing you've ever done in your life, from awards and scholarships right down to those old ladies you've helped across the street. I want everything. When that judge looks at you, I want him to see young Jesus himself. He needs to know a wrong decision is going to haunt him.
Uh-huh. Just like Pontius Pilate was haunted, I thought.
I can't believe it, said President Tuttle over ice cream. It was so close. I just can't believe it.
The hearing had lasted less than an hour and ended on a cliffhanger. Wilfred Ritchie had accepted President Harvey's plea bargain offer, whereupon we pled guilty before Judge Feather to the charge of public mischief. The judge then heard sentencing arguments from both sides, along with tearful character witnessing from my father and more practical testimony from President Tuttle, before calling a 24-hour recess to deliberate. Prez and my father then steered me past the handful of reporters lying in wait outside the courtroom and to a vinyl-padded diner several blocks away, where President Harvey soon joined us in a crowded booth. Wilfred Ritchie's request for 60 days in jail was still ringing in my head.
I thought we had him there, said my father, shoveling a spoonful of burnt almond fudge into his mouth.
His side was warm against me, packed in as tightly as we were. I was glad to see that his sweet tooth had returned.
It looked like we really had him.
I still just can't believe it.
President thumped the table, rattling our water glasses.
Heldershun, that judge was right on the verge of letting you go. Just like President Harvey asked, he was going to let you off with a fine. The words were coming out of his mouth, and then something pulled him back. The spirit was working on him, and he hardened himself. Oh, rats!
That judge is in a difficult position, said President Harvey. He knows the right thing to do morally. What he doesn't know is the right thing to do legally.
What do you mean?
Asked Tuttle. Harvey spread his arms as well as he could in the crowded booth.
Look, he's about to set a precedent. There's never been a case like this before in Canada.
I know, I looked. The next time this happens, what the judge involved is going to do is go to the casebooks and see how Josiah Feather decided in the Crone versus Shun. It's an awesome responsibility. It's one he can't take lightly.
My son is not a precedent, said my father. His lip trembled, and he put down his spoon. Doesn't he understand that?
He understands that, Brother Shun, said Harvey gently. That's why the decision's so hard. He scooped up a bite of his cherry ripple. It's out of our hands at this point. We've done everything we can. All we can do now is pray that Judge Feather talks to the right people tonight.
Who are the right people? I asked.
Harvey swallowed. Tonight, when he goes to hang out wherever it is that judges hang out after work, he's going to be asking for advice. He'll get with his other little judge friends, and he'll ask how they'd decide in his position. He took another bite of ice cream. So like I say, let's pray he talks to the right people.
Prez lent my father and me his white Chevy Celebrity for the evening, and I drove us to a Chi-Chi's not far from the mission office. That Chi-Chi's had been the scene of a riotous zone outing one P-Day in January, but now I chewed and swallowed my chicken chimichanga in self-conscious misery. This could very well be my last fancy meal as a free man.
Adding to my distress, the people at the other tables kept talking about me.
Or at least that's what it sounded like. I'd hear a snatch of conversation that sounded like
Eldershun,
or bomb threat,
or
missionary,
or
airplane, or prison. And the food would turn to mud in my throat. I was going crazy, or paranoid, or both. My father tried to keep up the conversation, God bless him, and we talked about my plans for life after mission service. Two likely futures, however, we talked around without ever bringing out into the open. Prison and marriage to Katrina. I wasn't sure which prospect my father found the more horrifying. The next morning, under a sky the color of old meat, my father and I went sightseeing.
I squired him around the city in President's big car, piloting it like a yacht through the steel canyons downtown. We gawked at the Calgary Tower and the Saddle Dome, and though I hunted and hunted, I couldn't locate the sculptures the other elders called the Naked Lakers, an installation in front of the Department of Education executed in rough bronze, depicting a group of a dozen or so impossibly tall and thin human figures at play. Distracted by my search for the Lakers, I accidentally turned down a transit-only street downtown. I completely missed the sign, and I only realized what I had done when I noticed the absence of other traffic, and the train tracks running directly ahead. There were no C trains in sight, but I decided to panic anyway. "Oh, crap!" I shouted, gunning the engine. We surged like accelerating astronauts to the next corner, which I rounded with one hand on the wheel and one on the horn. "What are you doing? Look out!" cried my father, attempting to press himself straight through his deep upholstered seat. Pedestrians scattered as we slewed around the corner back onto a safe street. I was lucky I didn't run anyone down. At the next red light, I tried to steady my breathing. My hands shook. "What the hell was that?" demanded my whey-faced father. "Transit-only street," I said. "No cars allowed, only buses and trains." My father made no reply. I waited, hands on the wheel, for the dressing down I was sure would follow. But it didn't come. I turned my head. My father's eyes were unfocused, his mouth slack. "Dad?" I said. Judas Proust, had I given him a stroke? He burst into sobs so suddenly I jumped. His whole body shook in great racking paroxysms. I had rarely seen my father cry, and never this hard before. A horn behind us honked, and I pressed the gas pedal. "Dad, are you okay?" I asked, driving only for the sake of doing something. He turned a mottled and tear-streaked face toward me. "It's your mother," he said, voice hitching. "She's praying for you right now." He touched his heart. "I can feel it. You're going to be okay. You're going to be okay." And the sobs started up again. Back at the mission office, a phone call from my father to my mother confirmed that she had been saying a prayer at some point during the previous hour. My father took this as confirmation of a miracle, but I still wasn't reassured that things would go well at the hearing. After a light lunch, my father and I rode with President Tuttle to the provincial court building. I should have been thinking optimistic thoughts. Instead, I was thinking of Joseph Smith and the words he had spoken in June of 1844 as he rode toward Carthage, Illinois, toward that city's mobs of angry, lawless militiamen, toward the last in the years-long string of jail cells where he'd wasted so many days of his life. I am going like a lamb to the slaughter, but I am calm as a summer's morning. I have a conscience void of offense towards God and towards all men. I shall die innocent, and it shall yet be said of me, he was murdered in cold blood. Joseph had harbored no illusions about what would befall him in Carthage. I tried to harbor none about myself. As we sat behind President Harvey in the dull orange courtroom, captives to an incomplete sentencing, the pokey seemed less than one galloping heartbeat away. It was waiting right there, on the far side of the wall behind the bench, radiating dread on a frequency tuned perfectly to my bones. President Tuttle tapped me on the shoulder and pointed across the gallery to two reporters we had seen the day before, a man and a woman. One wrote fair, balanced stories for the Calgary Herald. The other, breathless sensationalism for the Calgary Sun. "I can't wait to see what kind of hysterical fiction that woman writes for tomorrow," he said. "That fellow from the Herald, he's on top of things. He's probably taking notes for them both while she falls asleep in court." My father glanced over their way. "I think you may have it backward, President," he said. President's brow wrinkled. "What do you mean?" The reporters. I was looking at the bylines this morning. The woman writes for the Herald. The man is the one from the Sun. President looked at the reporters again, frowning, then looked back at my father. Are you sure? He's right, I said, shrugging. I noticed that this morning, too. Huh, said President in wonderment, watching the two reporters. Who would have thought? All rise, ordered the bailiff, and we stood. I glanced over at the prosecution table and saw Wilfred Ritchie standing as straight as a telephone pole, chin high, devilish black beard bristling. He looked confident. Judge Feather entered the courtroom looking like a crotchety old Western lawman who hasn't had a good bowel movement in days. He seemed even older than he had the day before, bent, bowed, flapping in black like a crow. But when we were all seated again, his voice rang out strongly. This has not been an easy case to decide, he said without preamble, but I have decided. Before I pass sentence, though, I'd like to briefly review the needs this sentencing must satisfy. He cleared his throat, took a sip of water. I wished I had some. First, there's the issue of deterrence. The Crone makes an excellent point when they ask for a sentence harsh enough to discourage others from committing similar acts. This court has no desire to convey the impression that crimes like this are acceptable, trivial, or tolerable. This demands that a jail sentence be imposed. I shivered. Prison guards walking over my grave. At the same time, however, this court has no desire to ruin the life of a young upstanding man with no previous criminal record. Mr. Shun has demonstrated a good attitude towards society throughout his life, and it is my considered opinion that he will never again see the inside of another court of law, in this country or any other. For that reason, a fine seems to be in order. It was the old justice and mercy shtick, translated from Sunday school to the courtroom, and I have to admit, he had me hooked. I still couldn't guess which way he was leaning. Judge Feather surveyed the courtroom with what struck me as a deliberately Solomonic portentousness. I therefore find that, in order to satisfy both opposing needs, a fine and a jail sentence are required. I think I died in that instant. Joseph's long months in Liberty Jail had come to an end in April of 1839, when authorities quietly moved him and his fellows back to Daviess County, Missouri. There, Joseph's lawyers argued successfully for a change of venue in the election riot case. On the way to the new trial in Boone County, however, a bribe of $800 plus a jug of honey-sweetened whiskey secured both freedom and horses for Joseph, Hiram, and the rest. Languishing in Carthage Jail in 1844, however, escape and rescue were only maddening fantasies. Governor Thomas Ford had guaranteed Joseph and Hiram's safety at Carthage until they could be tried for the destruction of the Nauvoo Expositor, but Ford drastically underestimated the enmity of the militiamen gathered in the city. On the morning of June 27th, a faithful Mormon named Dan Jones, out gathering intelligence for the Prophet, overheard a stump speech in which troops from the nearby city of Warsaw were whipped up to kill the Smith boys that afternoon, even if they had to tear down the jail to do it. Jones hurried with this report to the governor, who planned to travel to Nauvoo that day to address the Mormon people. Joseph had begged the governor to take him along, fearing that Ford's presence in Carthage was the only thing preventing a lynching. But the governor refused to believe the militias would be bold enough to provoke the Mormons while he lay vulnerable among them in Nauvoo. He left Carthage despite the report, without the Prophet. When Jones brought the news to the jail, Joseph scrawled an urgent message to the Nauvoo Legion and dispatched it with two riders. The Legion was to march immediately and break him out at all cost. but for some obscure reason, the order never reached Joseph's troops. Meanwhile, the Warsaw militia marched out of town with the governor far enough to allay his suspicions, then turned back and beat hell for leather to Carthage. Joining forces with the Carthage militia, they stormed the jail by light of early evening. Governor Ford had unwittingly signed Joseph's death warrant. Judge Feather stared down at me in the gallery with deep and unfeeling eyes. He might have been carved from a tree. "Therefore," he said, "I hereby sentence you, Donald William Shun, to pay a fine in the amount of $2,000, which fine must be paid from monies you have earned by your own labor." He inhaled through his nose. "And to serve 1 day in jail, applied retroactively. Case closed." He pounded his gavel and vanished in a swirl of black robes. The noise of the spectators roared in my ears like wind on a mountaintop, and I barely knew what was happening as the bailiff seized me by the arm and dragged me to the back door of the courtroom, into the gullet of the city jail. The four prisoners in Carthage jail heard shouts and shots at the entrance downstairs. Joseph and Hiram drew pistols smuggled to them by earlier visitors. Willard Richards and John Taylor had only hickory canes with which to protect themselves. All four pressed themselves to the cell's wooden door, but were forced back when gunshots pierced it. Joseph managed to get out of the line of fire as the door was battered open. Hiram, Joseph's older brother and closest friend, did not. The cluster of gun barrels bristling from the passageway beyond belched fire. Four shots caught Hiram in front, one of which shattered his face. A ball from the window struck him in the side. "I am a dead man," he cried as he fell. He never rose. Joseph emptied his pistol through the doorway, injuring three members of the mob, but killing none. A hail of lead shredded the air, from the doorway and the window both. John Taylor was hit 5 times, though his pocket watch stopped what could have been the fatal shot. Willard Richards, standing next to the door, thrashing at the guns with his cane, escaped serious injury. Their cell occupied the second story of the jail, and Joseph leapt to the window. A field of 100 black-painted faces awaited below in the ruddy twilight, bayonets upraised. According to some, Joseph shouted the traditional Masonic plea for aid to the crowd below. "Is there no help for the widow's son?" If he was hoping for the many Masons in the mob to remember their oaths, drop their weapons, and rush to his defense, then he was disappointed. In any event, they had no chance to act. That's when a ball from inside the cell struck Joseph in the back, and he toppled slowly out the window. I sat on a bench near the property window inside the jail, surrounded by armed guards and fellow prisoners. It seemed I waited there forever, in free fall, while the faces came and went and changed and vanished around me. An hour went by, then 2, then 3, and I discovered that having a watch didn't make the time pass any more painlessly. In some ways, it made it worse. I had originally spent only 20 hours in jail. The system seemed determined to rip those last 4 hours from me and balance the accounts. I was dressed in my full suit and tie, groomed well, and many of the other prisoners, waiting their turns to be processed in or out, watched me with hostility. Maybe they thought I was a lawyer. If they took it in their minds to lynch me, I wondered whether or not the guards would step in. As the 4th hour rolled around, as the waiting queue thinned out, I became aware of 2 rather scruffy and scrappy-looking fellows sitting at the far end of the bench from me. They were in their mid to late 20s. One sat back with his head against the cinder block wall, eyes closed, while the nearer kept watching me sideways and fidgeting. At last, having caught me watching back, the guy scooted a foot or two toward me. He pushed tangled brown hair out of his face and smiled ingratiatingly.
"How you doing?"
he said. I eyed him coolly. "Fine, just waiting to get out."
"I hear you, dude. What you in for?"
A little whitewashing didn't seem inappropriate at this point. "Hijacking."
"No way," the guy said, eyes widening. "Hijacking? What'd you do?"
I shrugged like it was no big deal. I said there was a bomb on a plane. His eyes lit up as if someone had just plugged him in, or as if the coke had just hit his bloodstream.
"Oh, hey, you're that guy that's been on the news."
I nodded.
"That's right."
"Oh, man," he said, squirming as if he'd just met his childhood sports hero. "I can't believe it. This is so great." He nudged his companion. "Hey, man, Brian, wake up, dude. You gotta meet this fella here, eh? This is the guy who blows up planes." The second man opened his bleary eyes and leaned forward to peer past his friend at me.
"Hey," I said casually, with a little wave.
"You're that guy, eh?" he said. I nodded.
"Cool."
I couldn't help myself. I grinned as wide as the planes. I had fallen among fans. Joseph clung bleeding to the windowsill for several long moments. Colonel Levi Williams, commander of the Warsaw Militia, ordered his men to fire. No one obeyed. In anguish, Joseph cried, "Oh Lord, my God!" and dropped half-conscious to the ground. One militiaman sprang forward and dragged Joseph across the yard. He propped the prophet against the curb of a nearby well as Colonel Williams organized a firing squad of four men. Joseph's eyes fluttered open as he stared at his executioners. Williams gave the order to fire. All four balls found their mark, and the prophet fell dead to the dirt. At 6 o'clock, the officer at the window called my name.
"Shun, you're up. Donald William Shun."
And it was finished. I was free.
Next time on The Accidental Terrorist.
In our next installment, Elder Shun may be free, but he's still a convicted criminal and has that fallout to deal with. How will the local Mormons react? Why is his father issuing a gag order? How will the church choose to punish him? Is there any way to make a profit out of this whole mess? And what about Bob? The patella-shattering answers.
Just 1 week from now!
The Accidental Terrorist. Spoken material, copyright 2007-2009, by William Shun. All rights reserved. For more readings by William Shun, please visit shun.net/podcast, or search for William Shun, S-H-U-N-N, in the podcast directory of the iTunes Music Store. This recording has been a production of Sinister Regard.